Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi, everybody.
Now, Brian couldn't be here today, and instead, I would say that we've brought in somebody else, but this is the fourth member of the crew. This is the guy that's the glue that makes everything happen. For those of you that never listen live, you may not be aware of how all this happens because of Mr. Bryce here.
Hello.
And Bryce, say hello.
Hi.
And I thought, we're like, oh, we need a third man. And I'm thinking, I know who the perfect person is. That would be Bryce. Bryce is the one who updates all of the links when we talk about stuff. He's pushing that through. He's the one that pushes on the website, our Facebook page, all that. Bryce is finding constantly all sorts of awesome, weird things. And
keeping it
we
weird.
Want to do to – you hear him. Hear him out.
Yeah. Producer would be a good one word description for everything.
He's a lot more than producer, though. You know, he's the blood of this machine.
He lives in our hearts. Mm-hmm. You know,
yes. Gentlemen,
swimming around.
Gentlemen,
yo.
This has been a very exciting this last week in science, and I don't want to tell you just why. I'm going to tell you a story. All right,
okay.
Two guys. One guy's name's Rick, other guy's name's Steven. Rick and Steven. Steven and Rick, they have a hobby. And their hobby is they like to go into caves. They like to climb down into the bowels of the earth through strange little passages. And they were doing some caving in northwest of Johannesburg, Africa, of course, and South Africa, to be more precise. And they're going through a region that's been a popular place for people to go caving. And they decided they would go a little bit deeper into where people haven't been before or kind of a less known place. And there's a constriction in the cave called Superman's Crawl. Superman's Crawl, because the only way you can fit through it is by holding one arm against the body and extending the other one above your head. Okay?
Okay.
So imagine trying to climb like that, and then you have to climb up a rock wall called the Dragon's Back. All right, so tight little passage where you can't even have your shoulder width apart. You have to be narrow enough to have one arm in front of the other and one arm in back of you. And they go through this, they go up on top of there, and then they find a little cavity, decorated stalactites, and deep inside they find a fissure and a finger of rock, and then below it some empty space, and then further down they find a vertical chute. Some places less than 8 inches wide.
Wow.
They manage, both these men are very slender, they manage to make it all down into there. They're described as having hyper-slender frames, all bone and wiry muscle. Had they been, I don't know, podcaster-sized,
yeah,
they would never have made it. They would never have gone down inside of there.
So is this like, are they pro? Like, is this like their thing? Like they are keeping their bodies in a certain way because they cave and this is an advantageous physique?
Yeah, this is an extremely skillful cave to go into.
Gotcha.
Now, do you know what they found at the bottom of that chute?
I mean, normally, all right, crazy stuff you find in caves. Paintings, body parts, skeletons,
treasures,
leprechauns.
Yeah.
You ready for this?
Yeah.
They found skeletons, not just any skeletons. Deep inside this cave, care to guess what kind of skeletons?
Ooh, so not human skeletons necessarily.
Yeah, like varmints, like raccoons or some small creature, maybe?
Raccoons not like being called varmints, by the way? Is that yeah. considered racist?
Have they filed a complaint? all right, down to the bottom, they found Hillary's lost emails. Oh, wait, Trump's credibility. Oh, wait, I did both, so now nobody can be mad at me.
Oh, man. Yeah, I feel like some sort of like a gecko, like a big gecko or like a gator-sized creature.
Like a Gila monster.
Yeah.
Like a huge – oh, my God. Like a dragon skeleton, some large
the dragon's
lizard.
Back. That's what it's called, right? Is it a dragon?
No, they did not find dragons, guys. Oh. Oh. Better.
Better.
Better. Better than dragons.
I would ask you to name the species, but you want to know what? You can't. You want to know why? Because if you don't know the story, this species didn't exist before these guys found it, and then the other explorers and later on the scientists and researchers went in there. Gentlemen, what they found was an entirely new species.
Jesus.
Of primitive humans. Homo naledi. N-A-L-E-D-I. Okay? And let me read the description of you, okay? The most important evolutionary find in human history in the last 50 years. That is what they found down there in the middle of the earth. And this is an area we call it the cradle of humankind because we found a lot of early fossils. And they'd been these guys kind of had a lookout, too, for the idea of maybe we'll find something down in there. And it's going to get a little bit more weirder in a second because let me pull up the description of this.
Picture here.
Yep. And so these species, they found piles. They found like 1,500 individual bones from this species of creature. It's very ape-like, had a smaller brain, a different kind of frame, maybe big hands. But what is peculiar about all of these fossils, all these bones, this is a site that could be as old as 2 million years ago, maybe 100,000 years. They're still trying to date it. These things aren't often as quickly as we would like. They're still trying to date this. They were deliberately placed there. Now, you saw the photo we saw was – or the recreation
That's
we saw
was –
That's
what I was going to ask.
What's that?
That's what I was going to ask is because this feels like a tomb. Like now we would think of it as a tomb, but I was wondering whether or not – because this I can't imagine geologically that things would have changed so much as you know these guys were to get in there with such tremendous difficulty. But it does seem like a place where you would drop bodies and just like leave them be.
So this is what's curious. So there's some great articles about this. And then when the scientists came in, like all the cavers that went in there to get them, by the way, after the fact, it was like an entire team of women scientists and researchers were the ones that got it out. So – and it's like if you ever seen the movie The Descent.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like that with a happy ending. So spoiler alert. So what they found down there, exactly, that's the curious thing, is they said it's not like a pit where – and like to get things into there, they had to go through this deliberate process to put it down in there. Mm-hmm. This was intentional burial of their dead. They only found a few rodents. They didn't find other animals that would indicate that there may have been some formation or some hole or some things got trapped and fall down there. For many, many years, this group – this tribe or whatever we want to call them, let's call them a tribe, even though, you know, they're closer to us than probably what a chimpanzee might appear to be, but they're still not fully what we look at when we look at other, like a Neanderthal. You put a Neanderthal in a business suit and, you know, you'd probably think, it's just some apish looking dude. These guys, you know, probably a little more monkey looking.
Let me ask you this. On the grand scale from we are grouping together because we stay alive better when we're together rather than we're apart to like using money as a form of society, where is burying your dead? Because I imagine in my head it's a fairly sophisticated element of a tribal society or of a civilization that like we don't just – you know, somebody dies and you don't just poop on them, you know, or like, you know, kick them over.
There is, you know, burial rites or burial treatment is a – it varies, you know, and it depends culturally. It has a lot to do with sort of your geology and where you live. If you're in like a really, really humid sort of climate, you want to bury stuff, you know, or cremate because you don't want it sitting around and smelling because you're going to smell it. Other environments they might do, you know, they have where they leave it out in the open for, you know, birds or animals to come and eat it and get whatever. When you have a lot more space, a lot more wide open area, and you can put it up in places to do that, that's tradition. Otherwise, so, you know, it depends upon what you think is expedient. If you leave a lot of bodies around in some places, you might start getting predators, and that could be a reason. And so here, it's even in today, it's based in part on practicality, just as it was back then. But the idea of, hey, let's go put this all the way down inside of this cave, it could have been ceremonial. And that's what's spooky is the idea that 2 million years ago, we could have had a hominid species. You know, again, an entirely different species that could have existed. We've talked about this before. 100,000 years ago, Homo sapien and Neanderthal, Denisovians. You had Homo florens, the little hobbit-looking dudes living near Indonesia, okay? Another group called S, which we haven't quite fully identified. Red deer cave people, that's six. Now we can probably maybe add, you know, Homo nodali, okay? It's another group. That's seven. That's seven. And this seventh one we did not know about until because only reason we know is because quite recently two guys went into a narrow 8-inch passage to look to see what was down there. If they hadn't done that, we would not know. We don't know what else is out there, but we can imagine 100,000, 200,000 years ago, our world was filled with all these different people who were very different. Trollish looking people, gnomish looking dudes, you know, tall dudes, small dudes. There were species of Homo erectus that were like 7 foot tall, while the average, you know, our ancestor at that time was maybe 5 foot three or so.
Man, this story, the caver story, just so much better than Stand By Me. Like, suck it, Wheaton. This is the best.
It's a great novella by Stephen King, though. You can find it in the collection called Different Seasons, along with Apt Pupil, Rita Hayworth, and Shawshank Redemption. And then I forget what else.
So you mentioned that they found some 1,500 bones. Is that right?
1,500 specimens representing at least 15 individuals. Skulls, jaws, ribs, dozens of teeth, a nearly complete foot, a hand, virtually every bone intact, as in life.
So it seems like this is part of... Like, even in modern civilization, we find crypts and places where bodies will reasonably stay intact for as long as they are until they tried or they quote unquote disintegrate kind of naturally. Like, that's something that we do. It's why we bury them in cool ground, and why, you know, crypts are in cool areas. Like, This does, and obviously this is us reading into, you know, what we have found and kind of assigning our own sort of narratives to it, and we need to remove ourselves scientifically from that. But it does bear a resemblance to this very modern way of thinking how we treat our dead, you know, or at least an idea that has stuck around through modern era.
It's... If you talk to a primatologist and you ask about, you know, when you teach an ape sign language, it can readily grasp certain concepts. Other concepts seem to be alien to them. You ask a gorilla what happened yesterday, and a gorilla will look behind them. You know, yesterday, tomorrow, all that. These are really, really vague notions. They live very much in the moment. They have memory, and they form these things. They look forward to stuff, but they to our understanding, in their head, they're not building up mental models of what they're going to do. You know, there's an interesting research where researchers put a tape recorder in the crib of a young girl who was maybe 2 years old, but she was verbal. And when nobody was there, this little girl starts to talk about, well, mommy's going to come get us. Mommy's going to help us change into our clothes. And then we're going to go have breakfast, and I'm going to have applesauce, and then I'm going to go to school, and then I'm going to do this. The girl or girl recites her entire day what she's going to do, and that's not all that weird. And you listen to little children talk, and you start to understand they have these ideas of things they're going to do, where that seems uniquely human or maybe hominid to some degree. And when we look at burial and all these other things, we're trying to find out. How do they see the world? The mirror test. You put a mirror in front of an animal, what does the animal see? You know, higher level animals, dolphins and some types of apes will go, hey, look, it's me. And they start mugging for the mirror. Other animals get nervous and scared of it. You know, put your cat in front of a mirror. They may not care. They don't see a face. They don't see anything. Or they may, you know, they just don't really see that it's himself. The mirror test is a really good test of intelligence. Or not a really good, but is one many of the signs. Burial rites, that's what we look to see, like Neanderthals. You know, we want to know, are they smart? And we look inside there and we find Neanderthal graves. We might find flowers. There's this red ochre, you know, this dust, this powder that we'll find in there that seems to be symbolic. There are these little things that we look for to say, did they have some concept other than just cover it up?
Right. So
that's fascinating. Right. And good on these dudes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, there's.
How extensive has their the research been on this the fossil site so far? If they've only found, say, 15 individuals,
this is a featured story right now. The research is active to try to start dating it. So this was when they decided to release it. Right now, going through all the little bones and trying to figure out which individuals, they've uniquely been able to identify 15 range of different ages. The next step is the better they can understand the conditions that these things were preserved in, they can start to get an idea of how old they are. But just to tell you just how uncertain it is, one of the leaders of the team, John Hawks, who I've been subscribing to John Hawks' RSS feed for about a year now. Prior to this, I had no idea he was working on this. He's got a great, great blog about evolution and explaining. Whenever there's some new report comes out, whatever, I go to his site. I found him when I was doing research on Neanderthals, and he had really good insights into it. You know, he says it could be 2 million years old, you know, and it could be, you know, 100,000. And so the find just got reported September 10th of this year. Here's the description. With a small head and brain, hunched shoulders, powerful hands and thin limbs, Homo naledi was built for long-distance walking, says Hawks. Fully grown, it stood about 5 feet tall, was broad-chested, walked upright, and had a face including a smile that was probably more human than ape-like. Powerful hands imply it was also a climber. So, again, we don't know it. 2 million or 100,000 years, you know, could be coexisting with humans at the same time. But we would have humans at that time that looked roughly like what we look like right now, and those dudes with the faces you saw. That's shaped so much of our psychology, the way we're hardwired. We're hardwired to think of others as being very, very different, very, very, very different. And as we just sort of ended up, you know, becoming the dominant species and then commingling with Neanderthals to the point that, you know, they went away or died off and just only 2 to 3% of their DNA is in, you know, people of European or Asian descent, and we became the one species, some of that hardwired biases or whatever still were left over, and I think we just apply that to, you know, other groups that actually genetically were just, you know, the same.
That is a fascinating idea that we have always been programmed to recognize and separate the other, that there is an evolutionary concept to that, like
and we don't know how much did we trade with them. You know, what was our interactions with them? Did we keep to ourselves? Were we very, very sparse? There are a lot of accounts. When you start reading, like when Alexander went all the way from Macedonia into India, and you'll find descriptions of forest people and descriptions of things that sound like they might have been another species of human, which is curious. And there are a lot of accounts of that where there could have been small pockets and small tribes of these individuals living a lot longer than we realize. We only know where we find fossils. We had no idea this existed until, you know, a couple of years ago or quite recently these guys went into a cave. This could have been an entire history that just was an entire species that never would have been found if nobody found it. We don't know what else is out there, and we don't know what else lasted in very remote regions.
It drives me crazy when everybody gets so, like, aggressive about, like, thoughts on science. Because, like, all of it, every scientific concept always has the unless dot, 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 right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, like, we know everything that we know unless something comes along that makes it totally different, you know? And, like, that's what it's, to me, it is the most fascinating and rad part about it is that, like, this is the game for which the rules get rewritten constantly. All we got to do is find new rules.
We've had this, and we've had to adapt that even – I would say that maybe when I was in school, you know, we had this idea that there was the long continuous line from modern-day humans to whatever we – you know, earlier forms we adopted from. Maybe Neanderthals were part of that, or maybe that was an offshoot. And that was kind of it, and it was just this, then this, then this, then this. And now that we understand that it's just this shrub of all these groups coexisting at similar times, and that's what made it confusing is we're like, we think we found an ancestor because it dates back to the right time. Oh, hey, guess what? Not everything that lived 200,000 years ago or a million years ago is related to us. We may share an ancestor, but they might just be country cousins.
Wow. That's it's like,
I mean, yeah. And what's interesting is, you know, what was the footprint of this particular species, the one that we found in the cave, when we had no other record of it except mm-hmm. for this, you know, fairly small burial pit. It's not like they found, you know, hundreds and hundreds of things in some mass grave that they had been putting people in. Seems like a fairly small group of at least what we can identify. So that's fascinating.
Well, get outside, but Bryce, you were going to say something.
Oh, I mean, I was going to say the overlap of all of these different human-like species makes, I don't know, it's really interesting thinking of like fantasy literature with all of these very human-ish species like Tolkien, all mm-hmm. operating sort of at the same time with their own history and their own lore, and how that is sort of becoming a little bit of how we are viewing humans and human-like species as potentially overlapping and coexisting at different times.
And that illustrates a point that's actually a theme of a book I'm working on right now, and that we went from, you know, the Tolkien based his stories, or a lot of his lore, on Scandinavian and Germanic lore, which is filled with elves and trolls and other creatures, and then, you know, little forest folk and all these things. And as we deep in, and for the longest time, like, yeah, those were fairy tales. And then, you know, science tells us, you know, the view then was, you know, we had one ancestor that we evolved from into this. And then now we've come to realize, yeah, that's true, but there were cousins and lots of cousins, and they're all living at the same time. It wasn't like one dominant species at a time did this. And that within the scope of modern human history, within the last 100,000 years, and pushing back, you know, we think Neanderthals maybe died out 40,000 years ago, and may have even been more, could have been other species that lasted longer than that. There may have been multiple, lots of them. And that's where those stories may have started from. And if you – we talked about this before on the last podcast, you know, Göbekli Tepe, this maybe 10 to 15,000-year-old structure that's in the middle of Turkey mm-hmm. that's a actually manufactured, you know, built thing that dates back to far beyond – you pick up any book. Like, I'm listening to this wonderful audiobook about ancient civilizations, and this thing is about 10,000 years older than anything in there. And so it doesn't take you too far to get a couple more generations back to when there were all those things you talked about living around there. And it very much is probably what inspired so many of these stories.
Fascinating.
Yep, absolutely. Another thing that's interesting is you take somebody like – you ever heard of the historical figure Sargon, right? Which we're talking back in, you know, Sumerian, Arcadian times. And this guy is just one of these first great military leaders that we know about his battles. We know about his conquests. We have a pretty good idea of where he reigned and what he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We have never found his city. We've never found the actual city that was the city that he ruled from.
So we have record of it. We do mm-hmm. not know where it is or what
we find in other cities. We'll find cuneiform tablets describing his accomplishments. Okay. And, you know, there's masks and things like this, just, you know, testifying to what this guy did. You know, it started the entire dynasty, the Akkad dynasty. Okay. You know, even had a chess game named after him. Okay. Mm. And as it pointed out on the Wikipedia right there, archaeologically, we've never found the capital. We've never found the center of his empire.
That's insane.
And there's,
I mean,
and
it's got to be. I mean, we have guesses, right?
We have sort of guesses, but then when was the last time you discussed the Elamites with a friend of yours?
Not so often, Andrew. Okay. I'm going to be honest with you.
Okay, when you had the Sumerian civilization, the Sumerian was a bunch of these different kind of kingdoms and places where you then got the stories like Gilgamesh and whatnot. You had other groups like the Elamites that they didn't leave a written record of what they were up to, okay? The Harappans, you know Mohenjo-Daro, okay? Mohenjo-Daro is this amazing complex in India, right? That's this – they've got drains, they've got indoor toilets, they've got this, you know, pretty sophisticated, you know, towns that they built. And it makes a lot of sense if you're kind of advanced and you're in a place like that that's got heavy monsoon seasons, all that, you want to get rid of water. you know, we thought that maybe there was Harappa and there was Mohenjo-Daro, these two ancient cities. We're like, oh, wow, look what they did. That's kind of cool. We found the remnants of 70 of these kinds of cities, not all the same size or whatever, but of this culture. But there's no written record. We didn't find any tablets or whatever of what they did. We have found actually some records, but we don't know how to translate any of it. We have no idea what they said or what they're up to. And you think, like, there's an entire – at one point we only got one or two. But back to the other point, Justin, you talked about the footprint. What was the footprint of Homo naledi? Now, we could say we only found this one small cave of them. Maybe that's it. One of my favorite examples is the chimpanzee fossil record. The last million or so years of chimpanzees, you can fit every single chimpanzee fossil we found inside of a shoebox.
Wow.
Because they live in marshy, wet jungle environments where you just don't get fossilization unless it's some rare extreme circumstances. Now, we know chimpanzees have a long history. We can look at their genetic history. But when it comes to their fossil record, it's non-existent. So I get excited when we talk about places like Doggerland, which is, you know, the region, you know, between, you know, the British Isles and Europe, which was once above water. When you talk about periods that were like, you know, during the Ice Age, which lasted a lot longer and most of the water was, you know, stuck up in glaciers and we had coastlines extended much further out. Whatever was living out there, whatever evolution happened among there and the reeds and the marshes or whatever like that, it's gone. We'll never know.
Yeah.
Probably.
No. Dude, the world is weird, that's guys. Insane. Because also, like, you had to wonder, so where was that? I mean, like, was this a special destination, you know, to mm-hmm. honor revered dead? Or was it, like, the worst? It's like, oh, my God, they suck so bad, we're going to put them down the cave.
What if they were possessed? What if they were the ones that had the instinct, or these are the ones that started to show a glimmer of intelligence that were just a little bit beyond, and they're like, no, we need to put you there.
Oh, jeez. I'll tell you what. If you are really, really smart, and you want to find a tiny little cave on the internet for which you can honor your respects, then go on over to patreon.com/weirdthings. That is where you are able to support this podcast. 453 patrons already do it. Why don't you become one of the selected few? Patreon.com/weirdthings. We thank you for your support, and gives Bryce a reason to come on out and help produce the show. Yes.
This is my
which, by the way, not an easy job because Andrew, Brian, and I
are jerks.
Are way or they're we're major league butts.
No comment.
All right, no, this is where you say no. You're not. Guys.
Oh, I mean, you're not. You guys are great. Right.
Oh, he didn't want to lie.
Is there anything else in the news of the weird, Andrew?
Well, I've got a couple more news of the weird. I got not so much news weird, but a little bit of disappointing news. I had the pleasure of, well, I think it was last December, going to the first test launch of the Orion crew capsule. I was invited by NASA as part of the program, NASA Social, and mm-hmm. we got to see a rocket take off with the Orion capsule, and then this thing went up, and the Orion capsule went around twice and then landed. I didn't see that part because I was in Florida. And it's an exciting thing. This is this capsule that we want to make part of our future into space, you know, the NASA future into space. Unfortunately, they have postponed what was going to be the first crewed mission, which originally was supposed to take place in 2021, which I think puts us at, what is that, episode 9? Star? No. Anyhow, 2021, I forget where we are in the Marvel Universe, too, with that phase 4. Sure. 2021, that was going to take place there, but then they've moved it back 2 years to 2023. They say after a design review and based on how much funding they have, they've decided it's going to be postponed to 2023 before the first time we get to test this new module. Good.
So here's where we get into what is maybe the canonical discussion of this podcast, specifically as it results to space travel. Because I got to wonder right now that Orion capsule, really, really cool thing. You got to wonder how cool that's going to be in 2023 with the like gigantic momentum that SpaceX has. Or maybe SpaceX is you know, they blow up a few more rockets and this time somebody's inside of it and SpaceX is no longer accompanied by 2023, which I guess is what the slow and steady win the race kind of idea. But what this seems like, we are missing our window for this thing to be super cool and relevant. I mean, 2021 seems like that.
Yeah, or at least the scale of it, right? Like, at that point, you could expect either a larger payload or a higher, a more crew to be able to go if you let it slip 2 more years.
They're not going to change much of the design between now and then. That's not the way the government works, and that's not the way NASA works, and that's not the way generally space works. You know, and you have to have that balance. And part of the problem, the challenge that NASA has to deal with, is they have to figure out what they want to be making 5 years from now when they go to Congress and ask for money, or 10 years from now to ask for money to fund for something. Mm-hmm. And it's run the risk of, well, next year they may not fund us, and so this project we put this much effort into. And you look at how many times this has happened. Like, you look at the James Webb Space Telescope, what that the original cost was, and then what that thing finally, you know, the final amount that, like, it looks like it's going to cost. It's incredible, and part of it is just bad planning, but a big part of it is just unreliability of Congress and consistency of there. But, you know, and just the inevitable problem of bureaucracies. And listening to this audiobook, which I mentioned before, about ancient civilizations, they talk about just, you know, how the Sumerians were frustrated by how big bureaucracies became and how they began to crumble and fall underneath the weight of them as more and more public officials were on the payroll and more people were getting, you know, the number of taxes that were being levied on, you know, the fish you caught and all these other stupid things, and people who were, you know, the inspectors of wild game and all these other things that just created this big, huge monolithic government that was, you know, this is 4,000 years ago. They were faced with this problem. They couldn't get anything done. And, you know, somebody might come along, you know, and it doesn't go away. And when you're trying to do something as complicated as space travel, you don't just have the technical challenge, you have that. And yeah, it kind of looks like by the time they finally launch this thing, they'll be waving at SpaceX as SpaceX is coming back from, you know, Mars.
Yeah, you know, and that's – it's just the – well, you want to know what? It actually is kind of the benefit – like – you feel kind of bummed because 2021 and 2023, and 2023 it is being delayed until then. You never know when, how far that delay is going to go. It feels like a long time because we have such amazing momentum right now that it is.
So that's eight. So what they're saying right now, in 8 years, 8 years from now, we will see the first new crewed NASA operated capsule 8 years from now. It was approximately 8 years from when JFK got up on stage and said, "Hey, let's go to the moon," that we went to the moon. Mm-hmm. And so we're now in a position from just strictly within the way the limitations NASA has to deal with, the way the government works, etc., that works saying, yeah, it's going to be 8 years before NASA, without the aid of private enterprise, will put, you know, private enterprise. I mean, these are private contractors and all that, but the official NASA spacecraft, we're 8 years from being able to put a man on a NASA spaceship.
So the argument would be because NASA is underfunded and we don't take space seriously. But in reality, a lot of it is, I mean, obviously JFK and you know, initiating the space race or America's participation in it was kind of a special situation for which he had a tremendous amount of support and political clout. But like this is kind of just the way of the world when it comes to government space programs.
Yeah, and right? I would say, you know, there are arguments to say that NASA also has a problem of mission creep, and that the, you know, NASA does a lot of great and amazing things, but NASA's become a big science organization that does a lot of things that don't really feel like they fall within what the original purview of it is. And we can make arguments for, like, you know, monitoring climate change and weather and these things are absolutely important things that need to be done. Do they need to be done by our space agency? Yes, satellites are in space. That is technically true. But, you know, is that all of a sudden making this, you know, Apple does great things because Apple says, you know, we're going to have very, very simple products. We're going to make very simple products. Google does search brilliantly. Everything else Google tries to do hasn't had the same level of success.
Same with Microsoft. You know, Microsoft, you know, made a operating system that could work with a variety of, you know, variety of desktops, variety of variety environments, variety of situations, and solve a lot of different problems. They do that really well. Mm-hmm. Other products they've tried to make haven't been as successful. And they've had some, you know, Xbox been good, but like there's the history of these companies when they try to get outside of, when Apple tries to get into, you know, media stuff. What's that?
Web services. I mean, Apple.
Yeah,
Apple.
Apple Web Services. You know, is still, you know, they're trying their best to make Siri super useful, but you still run into these issues there. You see that, and when they can say it's something we can put in your hand, you can hold on to, it's great. But when it's got to rely on everything else, not as much. You know, Tesla makes cars, SpaceX makes spaceships. Elon Musk has not merged these two enterprises together with SolarCity to try to create one super awesome company because he's going to put Glenn Shotwell over there at SpaceX, and she's going to do a great job. He's going to have his team at, you know, Tesla and his team at SolarCity, and that's part of the problem you get into is that a lot of the people running NASA, you know, there are people who are very, you know, a lot of scientists and stuff run it. They may not be the best people to figure out how to do procurement and how to get a rocket up into space. They can tell you what to do with it, which is great, but anyhow.
Well, you know, and you got to wonder whether or not that, you know, we got The Martian coming out, which has a very heavy theme in, you know, it is a very pro NASA story, mm-hmm. but it is very critical of NASA's bureaucracy and mm-hmm. I will, you know, paraphrase the opinion of the author based on his work that it is NASA's bureaucracy that holds it back, not necessarily the people within it, which is, I think, what has kind of been our point on this show. I mean, we've gotten kind of a rap of being, you know, anti-NASA, but it's like
not at all.
It ain't about NASA. It ain't about the people. It's just about, you know, bureaucracy and layers and the stuff they have to deal with.
It's like we've talked about that kind of like the way like Microsoft. Microsoft has got some of those brilliant computer scientists in the world, but you know, they're stuck in a model of a company that existed in the early 1980s and did gangbusters in the 90s, but 20 years later, trying to adapt has been problematic. And brilliant, brilliant, brilliant people. Google, same thing. Brilliant people, but how do you take these other awesome things and bring them into reality? You know, the core of Google Glass is a really cool concept. You know, and Google Plus and these other things they wanted to do, you go like, yeah, there's a really cool thing there, but there's so many interests that come into play. And the same thing with NASA, you know, like, well, yeah, our department's going to want a piece of that budget too, and we're going to need to have this oversight, and then we needed to do X, Y, and Z and this, and then, you know, I want to make sure that all I can keep my staff here for this amount of time. It's frustrating. But, you know, the biggest champions I've seen of, you know, SpaceX, you know, have been in NASA. And, you know, we have Jeff, and get exciting news is Jeff Bezos, Blue Origin, won their patent they tried to enforce saying that SpaceX couldn't land a rocket on a barge, got thrown out. You know, that was just dirty tactics. And I love Bezos, and I think Blue Origin could be exciting. This is another company, they're trying to build a, you know, a reusable rocket ship. But they're now said – they've announced they're going to be building in Florida. They're going to be building the Space Center there. They're going to be trying to develop their own private technology and working with NASA, et cetera. Overall, amazing time.
Insane. No, it's great. And it, to be honest, this is the stuff we should be frustrated about, you know, as opposed to just kind of the pat. I feel like if this story happens 8 years ago – and it's like, oh, well, this crazy NASA technology is now it's not just 6 years away, it's 8 years away. You know, you would have kind of gotten this chorus of like, well, that's what it takes to make space. And it's like, now we're not. Now we're like, oh, look, there's other people doing it faster and they seem to be going quicker. And, you know, how long was it from them announcing the Falcon Heavy to them launching a Falcon Heavy in the upcoming year? Like, you know, it was only a span of years, you know, like 3 years, not 8 years.
Right.
Well, I haven't seen the Falcon Heavy launch yet, though.
Yet, theoretically, but it's on the horizon.
So my question is, with sort of SpaceX and Blue Origin acting as head-to-head competitors, right? Is NASA a competitive force for these third-party companies, or is there an element of staying out of NASA's? Does SpaceX or Blue Origin have the motivation to make an Orion-like capsule within the next 8 years?
So, what you're likely to have, you know, SpaceX has the big leap, you know, leap on that. You have other enterprises too, like UL, United Launch Alliance, whatever, and they're ones who kind of are kind of traditional NASA contractors. What you're probably going to see, I suspect, is the Boeing CST, you know, crewed capsule, I think, is another one. I think more likely it'll be SpaceX or Blue Origin because they're okay with kind of using, you know, mad money to go spend, you know, let's to try to make something. I suspect, yes, you might see that there might, you know, I guarantee you somewhere in El Segundo, California, on a drafting board or in a computer system, you know, that Elon Musk has access to, there is a description for a, you know, the Dragon, you know, the third generation Dragon crew capsule, which will be much larger. You know, I'm sure, because he wants to go to Mars and he's not going to wait for engineers at other companies or other government organizations to design this stuff. Mm-hmm. He will design this stuff. There's a program which some NASA scientists, I understand, conceived of a couple years ago, and it just got resurfaced again, and that's called Red Dragon. And the idea there is to take a what's going to be an off-the-shelf Dragon capsule. And Dragon's the capsule that fits on top of the Falcon, for those of you that haven't been following on, listening to us for several years. Is to take the Red Dragon and then to outfit it with scientific equipment. Again, take an off-the-shelf thing like the thing we saw at the factory being made there, put some equipment into it, and then put it on top of a booster that can do a Mars-level trajectory and send this thing to Mars, let it land there, grab some rocks, and have the sucker take back off the surface of Mars and fly back there. They think this could be done by 2022. We could launch it by 2022. We could actually do a recovery mission of taking material off the surface of Mars and bringing it back to Earth.
Wow. And when's that other capsule supposed to launch?
Well, that'll be with people, but that'll be a year after.
Oh.
But that shows you there are scientists, there are engineers at NASA going, hey, these guys are figuring this thing out. We would love to use this.
That's the beautiful part about it, mm-hmm. is that, you know, that they are the, you know, to say to NASA, which again, best and the brightest, you know, among the best people to do it are working at this organization and working for our interest, to give them more tools to do what they do best is never a bad thing. And this is there are questions, like you mentioned, Bryce, about like, well, okay, well, does NASA doing it hinder private enterprise from wanting to build something that would compete with it? But I think at this point, there are singular missions for people like Bezos and Musk to tick off the boxes on their space goal list, and they will do that at any, you know, personal cost, and then finance their dreams based on, you know, selling that kind of technology to other people who want to use it.
I see. We, you know, and like guys like Larry Page and Sergey are obsessed with the progress of SpaceX. So you've got the two founders of Google, you've got Elon Musk, you've got Jeff Bezos, and then you have other players with an interest in it, you know, who are absolutely committed to seeing something happen. You have people with access to just build, you know, NASA budgets something around like $20 billion a year, give or take, or whatever. There's the amount of private capital that's actually interested in doing this now is colossal. Things are going to happen. And we've talked about before reusability. Once SpaceX is able to, you know, get that rocket back down on the pad and send it back up, that's going to be that. Somebody described it in the chat room as a Sputnik moment. It's a boom. There are points in human history when we developed things like, you know, special kind of keels or the ability to, you know, measure our distance as we traveled across, from being able to do longitudes, et cetera. That changed the way we looked at, you know, the world around us, and that will change the way we look at our solar system. Picks?
Let's pick it. I'm listening. This is a little bit more candy. I'm sure Andrew's got some really substantive, awesome stuff that's going to make your life smarter. Here's a really, really fun book that is a very unique nonfiction entity. I think Andrew and I have talked at length about how frustrating we find biographies, and mm-hmm. specifically when there is like really 60 pages of a biography, and then there are like maybe another hundred of context that makes that really doesn't move the story forward. Or you know, the other big problem with biographies is you just your story you're telling is informed by the sources that you get on the record, and ultimately that's who you know when you present, here's the story of famous person. It's like, well, that's really the story of famous person told by some family members that maybe like him or don't like him. An ex-wife who's, you know, says is fair, but always just giving her perspective. You've seen this a lot with Steve Jobs specifically, because, you know, there was a Steve Jobs that kind of existed before he left Apple, and then kind of after he came back, that seemed to be different people. I'm reading a biography called Johnny Carson that is fascinating. It is written by Henry Bushkin, who was his personal lawyer. And it does everything that I want this story to do. It makes no claims to be anything else other than this one guy's perspective. He obviously has a tremendous amount of respect for, you know, his client for decades. And, you know, but also is fairly frustrated by him. It is all written from the perspective of, hey, look, this was all stuff that was attorney-client privilege. I waited 10 years after he died, and now I'm going to, you know, just because it's a fascinating story, I'm going to get it out there. Wow. And it is beyond all that. It hits all my bases for what I want from it kind of journalistically, and that it gets right to the point. There's no three chapters about Henry Bushkin's life as a child and how he always loved the cinema. Like, it's just what you want. It is him telling stories about Johnny Carson in chronological order. It is awesome so far. And just, you know, how can you not love stories of a totally blotto Johnny Carson who just found out that his wife had a secret apartment with Frank Gifford, telling him, you know, Frank Gifford plays three positions when he suited up for the Giants. And I couldn't get Joanne to do more than two. it's just amazing stories. Johnny Carson's a fascinating figure. I highly recommend it. And in terms of the audiobook, it's not read by the author, but it is read by how you imagine a attorney born in the Bronx would sound. And so it is authentic in its narration, and is just fantastic. I've had a real fun time with it.
I've heard about this, and I have hesitant towards it because, you know, the fact that it was Johnny Carson's attorney doing this, and yeah, the privilege, you know, expired, but it's like, man, but yeah, this is stuff that Johnny never would have wanted you to tell. You know, you're the one person that he legally never wanted you to tell this sort of stuff about, and that kind of leaves just a sour taste in my mouth. I'm biased to that. I did my after school program, of which I got to meet Mr. Justin Robert Young. And that was funded because of a grant Johnny Carson, while living, gave to the James Randi Educational Foundation to, you know, encourage my, you know, projects in schools and teaching critical thinking. And so, you know, it's sort of a weird thing where I think of so much what I've been able to do has been because of, you know, the generosity of that guy. But I want to know his life story.
This is a highly, highly, highly sympathetic, you know, telling. He has a tremendous amount of affection for Johnny. I don't know if in the book there is a rationalization beyond, you know, that this is just something that I wanted to say, but it is, you know, listen, it's certainly something that Johnny probably, you know, he was a tremendously private man, and he probably, you know, unless later in life he had, you know, questions of legacy and having that cemented on some level, you know, maybe he, I don't know, maybe his thoughts evolved on it. I'm not going to pretend like I know what Johnny Carson would have thought about it. But I will say that I don't believe it is to be unfair. And I think that I am comfortable with him telling his version of this, you know.
I'll probably listen to it. Have you listened to the Hope biography yet?
No, not yet.
I highly, highly recommend you check out Hope, Entertainer of the Century by Richard Zoglin. It is an amazing story of a guy that this is a guy that went from performing in dance halls. You know, we hear about, oh, he started in vaudeville. No, he started way before vaudeville. He was doing dance halls, little theater, then vaudeville, then doing Broadway, you know, theater shows, radio, film, and TV. This guy made all these different jumps from one medium to the next one as one died out and one became popular. No other entertainer has ever done it like Hope did. No other entertainer was able to adapt and evolve like he did, you know, to the point that people said, you know, why are you still getting on stage? You know, but it's because he won. It's just – it was his calling. Bryce, do you have a pick?
You know, I'm not much of a reader, but there was an album that came out this year that has really mystified me. You know – I listened to kind of a weird collection of music, so I don't usually find entire albums. When I think of entire albums, I want you know, consistency in sound, consistency in thematics, and musical aesthetics. But when I first heard the lead single from this that came out in 2014. Not only did you have a very unique modern sound, but also very interesting lyrics. It's a pop. It's kind of a pop song and a pop album, but it has a very personal depth, and it doesn't feel very. It doesn't feel base or banal. And so this is called "The Fool" by Rin Weaver. It came out in June this year, and I just think it's spectacular. It's probably it's one of a handful of albums I've ever listened to that I can enjoy start to finish, front to back, every track, anytime. There's an interesting meta story going on. It's not a concept album in that it's trying to tell one linear narrative. It's a very interesting cyclical story of, at least the way I interpret it, of this character that wants to be a free, you know, a free spirit living on the road, living life to the fullest, who continues to just sort of end back up in the safety of whether it be a romantic partner or just settles down eventually. There are clues that are hidden in between each song. So, like, there's the very beginning of the album starts with this melody that ends up being this end tag near the end of the album that is like this almost like it like it sounds like it was recorded on her phone, but she's singing it sort of wistfully near the end of the album, and just the whole I don't know. I don't.
What genre would you put it in? Listeners also liked what kind of acts?
It's mixed. Because you've kind of got the radio singles, which are sort of pop with a little bit of like hip hop flair. Uh-huh. If you know Benny Blanco, he's produced like Kesha's stuff and Katy Perry. But also Michael Angelikos, he's the lead singer of Passion Pit. I think Passion Pit is probably a good similar sound.
So melodic,
alternative,
you know,
and acoustic pop.
Gotcha.
There's one song near the end that sounds Landslide. Like I listen to it and I think it's Landslide Part 2.
Yeah.
But then you've got this other stuff that's got these really interesting vocal effects. And at the end of the day, not only is it something you could enjoy front to back, but it's also just something I can put in my playlist of all of music I would just like to listen to. That's my pick.
Cool. Our first music pick ever on Weird Things.
I know. Really? Jeez. Yeah. I think it's definitely,
it just got hipper around here.
I know.
Yeah, guys.
I guess because either
we like music too. We're cool.
Like, really,
just
I mean, like
two
Andrew,
guys having a good time. Having a good time.
I guess it's one of those things where I don't talk about music all that much. You know,
you're super into it though.
What was that?
But you're super into it. You're super knowledgeable about it.
I mean,
you have your own taste. You have.
I try to keep up with what the kids are listening to. But yeah, no, I mean, Andrew, you have, certainly. How would you describe your music taste? I don't want to go out on a limb or anything.
I'm very, very eclectic, but then, you know, I'll hear something and I'll get into it and be like, I remember when, you know, and it's going to sound like, when I heard Lord on like a college station when that first broke, you know, first before, you know, it was like that summer, whatever, before she broke, I'm like, oh, this is really cool, you know, and then like Ellie Goulding, you know, I'm like, oh, I really dig this, you know, I'm not into like, you know, oh, Basement Chimpanzees, those guys are great. Like, I don't pretend to have any kind of insight or knowledge. There's things that I like and then get into it. And then I go, oh, this is kind of really cool. And then I can get into stuff that just, it's very hard to predict what I will like. Because, you know, but yeah. You know, somebody mentioned I only listen to Kraftwerk. Yes, that is true. Autobahn is the greatest song ever.
And Brian almost exclusively listens to
Fundamentals.
Australian rap music.
Yeah.
You know, he has one hip hop album that he only has room in his heart. He has a one hip-hop album shaped hole in his heart, and he takes one out and replaces it with another.
I'll say this, like, I seriously I think Taylor Swift is great. I genuinely, because, like, as a writer and as somebody who loves to, you know, really good storytelling from a point of view, you listen to one of her songs, and I'm like, you know, Blank Space, all that stuff. I mean, this is like, it's like, you know, yeah, it's enjoyable. There's a story there. She's telling a narrative. Yeah. She's a bit of an angry chick, you know, and a bit psycho, and she knows that. I mean, these things are, you know, I dig that kind of thing, you know.
What's fascinating with Taylor Swift stuff, and I was thinking about this because I saw some television thing where she was on a list of, like, most powerful people in entertainment, and usually the list is, like, people who have just amassed gigantic fortunes, and she's certainly not – as rich or in like big executive positions like a lot of other people on the list, but she earned her position because she had, you know, taken such big stances with Spotify and with Apple Music and was proving to be a very pivotal figure in what will obviously be the new economic model for music in general.
Yeah.
And it was really fascinating because it's like she only has that power because she's a great pop songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
Like if that album that she just released comes out and it's not good, nobody listens to her. She can write on that Tumblr, you know, all day long, and no one's going to care.
Well, that's true of every celebrity, and you
certainly
know, but
so. And I think what happens is some slowly parlay. They are successful enough that they make their way into executive capacities. And I wouldn't be shocked if you know you saw Taylor Swift do that.
Her letter to Apple about, you know, the Apple, you know, the Beats One and the streaming and not paying people the first 90 days, the way she wrote it, the way she explained how it really affected the, you know, the younger, the independent artists, whatever, was a masterclass. She and whoever her people, and maybe she, maybe she wrote it with some assist, maybe, or she just wrote it. I think she's very bright. It was classy. It was the way to handle something and say, hey, I don't agree with what you're doing. I'm not going to call you a jerk. I'm not going to call you greedy. I'm not going to tell you this. I'm going to tell you why I like you, but I'm going to tell you why I think that maybe you need to be over here instead of there. And it was wonderfully done. And it was a great example of how I think, other than you look at people who, you know, we want to be outraged. We want to be angry. We want to take power to the man. And she said, hey, you guys do awesome stuff, but here's the problem I see with this.
Well, and it was also shrewd, you know, I mean, because I agree with everything you said, but that essay was titled Why I'm Taking My Music Off Apple Music, you know, and it started from the position of I'm gone if you do not address these things, which is, you know, a sign of somebody with power that this is how you move something is by
there's a reason paid attention because of that. But she made sense, which most people do.
No, absolutely. 100%, 110%.
It's also indicative of how powerful whether it's her negotiating skills or whatever, but she's the biggest pop star on the planet, and she's technically an independent artist. Mm-hmm. Like, she's, you know, if you compare it to, like, a Beyonce or a Drake, she's not tied to one of the major record labels. Conglomerates, which is kind of... It's a boldness to... reject. Obviously, there have to be some sort of offers from these companies, but to say, you know what? No, I'm actually good on my own, and to be able to pull it off is it's a sign of her power.
Mm-hmm. Well, gentlemen, let's jump right into After Things. So I'm going to say it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.